no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
Welcome to the Start Me Up podcast, part of MSW Media and the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. I'm your host, Kimberly Johnson in D.C., and today my guest is Qasem Rashid. He's a human rights lawyer, author, Sirius XM host, and he's the creator of the Let's Address This Substack. I wanted to talk to him today because he wrote this wonderful article about that rape academy. So we're going to get into it, but before we do... The Start Me Up podcast is independent and woman-run. I offer a show every Tuesday just for patrons called What's Up, where I get a little more personal and talk about whatever's on my mind. I also offer an ad-free tier with a much shorter intro. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup. Look at the different tiers and support the show today. Now, please enjoy my conversation with Qasem Rashid. Welcome to the show, Qasem.
Great to be here, Kimberly. Thank you for having me.
I'm so grateful to have you. I think you're totally awesome. And I was doing some research because I told everybody in the intro, we're going to be talking about that piece that you wrote on the online rape academy. Oh my God, it's just so infuriating. And yeah. I'm so glad you wrote it. But before we get into that, I did, you know, I talked about your Substack and I talked about that the fact that you're a lawyer and all of that. But just doing my research, I'm going to do this really quick, and then I just want you to talk about it. So sure. I found an article, or actually it was a video, of when you were running for office in Virginia in 2020, and some, I believe, MAGA man said, I won't even repeat it, and I don't remember exactly what he said, but he just said something horrible about you because you're Muslim, and you saw this tweet, and you responded to him, and not only, like, I know that you saw that he was looking for, he had a GoFundMe for medical bills, and long story short, you basically helped him get those medical bills covered, and you changed his mind, so, because you're a good person, and I just want to hear that story. Please share from your perspective.
We live at a time of immense divisiveness, and a lot of that has been empowered by Donald Trump and what he's being called as, you know, a truth teller, but it's actually just, you know, unvarnished bigotry. And this is a person who saw that I was running for office as an American who happens to be Muslim and felt that it was his patriotic duty to send me some really nasty anti-Muslim remarks. And as you know, normally I just block and move on because I don't have time to deal with these trolls. But I also happen to believe that healthcare is a human right, and every human being has the dignity to healthcare. Which is why, you know, I'm sick and tired of politicians who want this for-profit exploitative system, which is literally killing people. Long short of it, I noticed that he had a GoFundMe because his wife had a crippling health condition, and they were about $25,000 in debt. And so I just did what I could. You know, when you're running for office, you don't have much money because, you know, when you're not independently wealthy, you don't have much money. And so I donated about 50, 55 bucks to his campaign and said, hey, this guy, and I tweeted out that this guy hates me because of my faith. My faith calls me to serve all humanity. So I've donated to his GoFundMe in hopes to help him cover his healthcare costs. And if you feel compelled, do the same. Unexpectedly, it went viral. And within 24 hours, his entire medical bill was covered and paid for in full. And, you know, the reaction from him was, you know, very positive, and he responded very apologetically and asked if we could meet, which it turned out he actually ended up being a quasi neighbor. He lived just a couple of miles down the road. And I think to me, that was another reminder that while a lot of these trolls may be bots hiding, you know, behind a screen in some other country, somewhere else in the world, there's enough of our fellow Americans who have bought into this disinformation campaign. And sometimes it can be a good thing to find ways to build bridges. I don't expect everyone to do that. I don't expect anyone to be the martyr for the cause. But for me, it worked out really well in that situation. And we were able to show just a living, breathing example that we don't actually have to have a politics of hate. We can have a politics of compassion and unity, especially in these difficult times.
So let me ask you, before we get into this whole piece that you wrote, I do just kind of want to ask you how you're feeling right now. I mean, I'm going to Greg Oliar wrote a piece, I think it was last year on his Substack, where he was kind of comparing the differences between the early rise of Hitler and, you know, what's happening in America. And he was basically saying that there was no resistance, right? There was no resistance from the media. There was no resistance from the government. There was no resistance from the people. And that we have that on our side. And then there's also kind of the thing, like I think these fascists are coming in fast and hard, as opposed to slowly boiling the frog, right? Where people are seeing the results of the fascism very quickly, as opposed to just slow baking it in, where they don't really realize what's going on. So I wanted to ask him, and I don't think we're out of trouble or anything like that. Obviously, we've got a world of trouble that we're dealing with and will for a while. But I mean, are you feeling hopeful? What do you see when you see our American government right now, even though it's like falling apart and almost destroyed?
Well, I'll say two things. One, I'm always hopeful. I'm an eternal optimist. James Baldwin has a great quote where he's asked about his despair for the world, and he corrects the journalist and says, I'm angry at the world, but I don't despair because I can't tell my children that there's no hope.
Right.
And I think he's exactly right. So I'm an eternal optimist. I look at our world history. I look at our American history, and we see dark times. We see times of immense injustice and dehumanization of Black people and of women and of indigenous communities and of, you know, immigrant communities. And we pushed past through extraordinary efforts, no doubt about it. But I feel confident that we will overcome. That hope is everlasting. The second part of your question about how I feel about the American government, I want to be very clear. I believe that Donald Trump, as horrible as he is not the cause of our problems. Mm-hmm. He's a manifestation of the injustices. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that the Democratic Party makes is they try to paint him as the root cause of every problem that ever existed. And that's just not true.
Right.
We can go back to Nixon being pardoned when he clearly committed a crime, mm-hmm. and he was pardoned. Why was he pardoned? If he had been held accountable, it would have sent a message to other would-be corrupt politicians that, hey, even the president will be held accountable. I think one of the biggest mistakes ever made was to pardon Nixon. Mm-hmm. The corruption of Ronald Reagan with Iran-Contra, he faced no accountability there. The fact that the Supreme Court was allowed to steal the 2000 election with no meaningful accountability. The fact that George Bush was allowed to wage two illegal wars, kill literally millions of people, waste tens of trillions of dollars, and face no accountability. The fact that Obama continued to allow Gitmo to perpetuate and increase drone strikes. You know, I can go on and on and on. And I think the point that I want to make is that what we're seeing now, you talked about the boiling frog scenario, did not start boiling in 2015 or 2016 or in 2024. Right. It started boiling 40 years ago, and now it's just the heat is much more visible at this point. I still don't think we're at a point of no return. I still believe that we can come back from this, but it is becoming much more difficult. That's true.
Yeah, and it's going to take a long, long ass time.
Yes.
But, you know, I mean, I keep saying the worse it gets, the better it's going to get. Because it's like, I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg did say the pendulum always swings. And I mean, history shows us that. And history shows us that. You know, I mean, I've been saying this forever. The more finally when people are uncomfortable is when they move, when they act, when they engage. So I think a lot of people are uncomfortable now. And I don't think the Democratic Party should rely on the fact that the other side is just so awful. I mean, I think there are a few people in the Democratic Party right now that I really like because they're strong and they're punching back hard and they're saying the things that, you know, we need to reform the court. We need Medicare for all. So I do think that while, you know, we're always, I mean, and I don't necessarily want to pick apart the Democratic Party because they are the closest thing we have to a matriarchy right now. But like any government, there's corruption everywhere and there's always problems that we have to take care of. And I do see, at least with this kind of like new, there's some new energy in our party and that's making me hopeful. And
I agree.
You know, it's exciting.
No, I agree. And I mean, I think two things can be true at once, that the Republican Party is basically irredeemable at this point. You know, there's really nobody that I would look at in that party and be like, yeah, I can see them being a viable leader. unfortunately, right? I mean, maybe on the issue of the Epstein files with Thomas Massie,
but that's kind of
a very narrow focus.
Yeah.
On the Democratic Party, there are people that I find honestly just as bad as Republicans, but I also find people who give me a lot of hope. You know, Senator Chris Van Hollen, I think, is a great example.
I love him.
He's fantastic, right? You got, and of course, the AOCs of the world and Summer Lee and Ayanna Pressley and Elizabeth Warren. I mean, I think there are great examples of people who are doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, on the young front, you've got people like, you know, Justin Jones and Justin Pearson in Tennessee.
Yes.
You've got Francesco Hong in Wisconsin. You've got, you know, some amazing candidates running for office and Abdul El-Sayed in Michigan, Salam Butti in Virginia. I'm a big fan of Graham Plattner because of the way he's running his campaign as an economic populist and really focused on not left versus right, but top versus bottom. And that goes back to the point you're making that there's just so much, you know, political corruption and corporate corruption that we need to get out that's infected both parties.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me has to kind of be the mantra going forward, that I'm interested in the candidate who recognizes that economic justice is the kind of core principle of our time. If we can ensure that people have enough to you know, work where they live or live where they work, where they have enough to put food on the table for their kids, where they have enough to you know, ensure that if their kid wants something nice, they can buy it without having to sacrifice diapers. I mean, basic stuff, right? No one's asking to buy a solid gold car, right? Like we're talking about, give me a living space that is basic human dignity. And I don't think that's a left versus right issue.
No.
That's a human dignity issue. And that only happens when we have people who are in office who are funded by people, not by the mega corporations who are trying to draw blood from a stone.
So much to tackle. There's just so much, but let's take this over to what you wrote.
Yes.
And I just, first of all, I want to say that the title of the piece is Men, We Need to Talk About Rape Academy. And I'm so glad that that's how you titled it. And I'm just going to get into that. I have so many questions that I don't know if I'm going to get through all of them. However, I want to preface this by saying that, you know, as a woman, and I will be adding in as we go through, but as a woman, you know, who has a feminist and a big mouth when it comes to all of this kind of stuff, I have seen, I will say, since like 2012, at least online, I have seen an improvement on how men react when they hear women who are so upset. They're still getting super defensive, as you know, with the whole not all men thing, and they get super defensive about everything. But I've had experiences where, like, for instance, in 2012, there was somebody who wrote a woman who wrote a blog about just everything women have to do to stay safe. And, you know, I mean, we get these emails all the time. Don't go out at night. Look in the backseat of your car before you get in. Hold the key between your fingernails. Don't wear a ponytail because rapists like to pull you in the bushes with your ponytail. I mean, like, we're constantly being warned about rapists at every, you know, everywhere we look. But then all the men are like, no, I'm not a rapist. And so anyway, this guy, I had posted this article. And this man, I said something like, everyone needs to read this. And he took great offense to it and basically started pounding his chest and saying how if anybody raped his daughter or his wife, he'd kill them. You know, this performative bullshit.
Yeah.
And that means nothing because he's not going to go out and kill anyone. He likes to say it online, but he's not. Okay. So you specifically say this article is not for women. And I would just like you to just address why. Why did you write this for men?
Because it's men who are the problem here. And I mean, that's just a very short, simple answer. It's the men who are the problem here. 98% of men who commit rape aren't going to prison. One in three minimum women will suffer sexual assault at some point in their lifetimes at the hands of men. When a gun is present, women are 100 times more likely to be killed by that gun by a man. And the list just goes on and on. And by the way, this is all in the backdrop of women getting no financial autonomy until 1974.
Mm-hmm.
Women, marital rape still being legal until 1993. I mean, it's just insane that we even have to have these conversations. We remember 1993. We remember these dates because they were yesterday's newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think part of the problem that we're in right now is so much of the framing, as you just really beautifully said, Kimberly, is around what women need to do better or how they need to be safer.
Mm-hmm.
And there is comparatively a fraction of that conversation on how men need to actually be accountable for the world that's been built the way that it actually is. And that's kind of been the genesis of this entire conversation. I have another article coming out that is going to piss off men a lot. And the article is titled, very simply, Women Are Not Safe Around Men.
Mm-hmm.
And I present the facts just to make it extraordinarily clear that there literally is no scenario where women are safe around men, factually speaking. Because look, we can talk all we want about, hey, be careful walking alone at night because you might get assaulted. But the facts remain, the undeniable facts remain, that the vast majority of women, 90% of women who are killed by a man knew their killer mm-hmm. in advance. So you can focus on the 10%, and you should. You shouldn't ignore that 10%. But 90%, 9 out of 10 women who are killed by a guy they know. So why are we focused? Majority of the conversations are around, right. you know, hold your keys in your fingers, or, you know, wear, you know, have mace, or you know, wear some kind of a firearm on you so you can use it, when 90% are a husband or a boyfriend or a sibling or a neighbor. I mean, that's a horrifying thing. And until men take accountability, and this is the line that I said in there that I didn't expect this to get this much of a response, but it did, was, and I think you know which line I'm talking about, but when I pointed out that this is the part where men say, this doesn't apply to me, I've never committed rape.
Mm-hmm.
And I respond, let me be direct, you do not get a cookie for not being a rapist.
Yes.
This is not an accomplishment. It is basic human decency, the absolute minimum, not a ceiling.
And that's, I mean, I hear that constantly. I yeah. heard that... from, I can't remember, I don't think it was about the Rape Academy, but I was just posting about rape in general, and this guy who was following me on Blue Sky, and he just kind of had the eye, he was like, this is how I would assume he was talking. Why are you yeah. making this all about me? You keep making this all about me. And I kept trying really hard to not be an asshole and to not yeah. be sarcastic. And I explained it as best I could. And I said, you know, when women are in a room alone with a bunch of men, we don't think they're all rapists, but we have to assume
sure.
that they are because, yeah. you know, we don't know which one.
That's right.
And, you know, I mean, I have so many personal stories. I have so, I mean, I don't have personal stories of rape per se, but I have personal stories of the fear and of being afraid that I was going to be, you know, I mean, I'm not going to get into all those for several reasons, but trust, you know, every woman has them, and women
That's
have
right.
stories of being sexually assaulted and raped. And the last thing we need to hear from some rando online is, well, I'm not doing it. Why are you painting me as a rapist? You know, you're losing followers because you're just painting everyone as a rapist. And that's kind of the attitude that we're getting. And it's fucking infuriating. You know?
It should be infuriating because it's also a confession, right?
Yes.
Like, imagine if I came to you randomly, Kimberly, and or you said something to the effect of I hate pedophiles, and my first response is, well, I'm not a pedophile.
Right.
Like, well, when did I say you were? Like, what are you getting so defensive about, right? Or if I came to you, Kimberly, and said, hey, by the way, I just want you to know, I do not have 5 dead bodies under my porch at my house right now. Like, who says that?
Right.
Unless you definitely have 5 dead bodies under your porch. And that's the point I'm trying to make out of these men. I'm like, you are confessing to something. Hit dogs holler. And your hard drive is the first one that we should be checking right now.
<I know. laughs> Okay, so you talked about systemic male violence.
Yes.
So I want you to talk about that beyond like individual criminal acts. But what do you mean when you, I think I know what you mean, but I want you to explain it for the people who don't know what that means.
Yeah, I mean, this is, and the data around this is so overwhelming. RAIN records a lot of this rape, abuse,
yeah.
and incest national network, that 98% of men who commit rape will never spend a single day in prison. 98%, right? I mean, that is an extraordinarily horrifying number, that 98% of men who commit rape will not spend a single day in prison. It's because our criminal justice system was built by men,
mm-hmm.
is run predominantly by men, and has been structured consciously or otherwise to protect men from accountability. There's a recent example in Utah. I think the Senate leader's grandson committed rape. And what did the Senate leader do? He changed the law before his sentencing to prevent him from facing any kind of meaningful jail time. He changed the law. This happened just a month or two ago, earlier this year in 2026. And so, you know, the 82% of underage rape victims and 98% of adult rape victims are women. And it's men who are committing this rape. And, you know, you go around, and this is some of the data I have in this new article that I have coming out. But you go around the world and you find this is actually not any particular country that is like better or worse. I mean, sure, there's worse countries, but there's not a single country on earth that has gender parity or gender equality. Not a single one, nowhere in Europe, nowhere in Africa, nowhere in Asia, nowhere in North or South America. In every country of the world, women suffer a disproportionate level of gender-based violence, and rape is an epidemic concern throughout the world. I mean, this should be horrifying mm-hmm. for every single situation. 57% of women who are killed by an intimate partner. 57%. And so when we talk about the solution to this, if we are putting the onus on right. the victims, then we will never, ever, ever have a solution to this. If cars are being driven into trees on the side of the road and we keep blaming the trees, we're missing the point, right? There's something wrong with the goddamn car.
Right.
In this situation, it's men who are committing rape of women. And if we're blaming women for not, you know, why were you wearing that? Or why mm-hmm. did you drink that? And not the guy doing the actual horrific crime, then we're completely missing the point. And this is where I just need men to understand that when we call this out, I'm not accusing you individually of being a rapist. What I'm calling you out on is not leveraging your platform to make sure there's meaningful accountability. And you can do that a number of ways. The easiest way is raise your voice to say there should be no refuge for this. Mm-hmm. The more difficult conversations are the people in your life that are committing these acts, letting them know that there's not going to be any refuge in you and that you will hold them accountable for this. Mm-hmm. And then where I want men to really be involved in is men disproportionately control a significant amount of wealth and power in this country. What causes are you donating to? What organizations are you supporting? Who are you electing to office? What pieces of legislation are you trying to get passed to make sure there's meaningful accountability? And if you're not doing those things, then I'm sorry, you are complicit with the person actually committing rape because you are standing by while they're committing a horrible crime and not leveraging your power to stop them from committing this horrible crime.
Right. I mean, it's exactly what we're seeing, you know, like ICE or something. People, you know, if you just stand by and watch, it's you've got to speak up. And yes. we see that from men online saying that about other things. And I just kind of want to throw in there, I don't remember the date I wrote it. It might have been 2021 or 2022. But I wrote something called No Jail Time for White Men Who Rape Women and Babies, which was a really fun headline to write. But it just, you know, I went and I looked for all these white men and it was just disgusting because, yep. I mean, they were literally raping babies. And then the white male judge would be way more concerned for the rapist's future than yes. the person who was assaulted. And this, like you're saying, this is a patriarchal construct. This is a system run by men protecting men. And I mean, we see it time and again. And then, like you said, it's constantly blaming the victims for what the men are doing. And I mean, we see this in religion. I've seen just recently, you know, like the evangelical crowd talking about how women shouldn't go to church, you know, wearing something that's revealing their shoulders. And, you know, what is that really saying? That, like, I'm constantly getting accused of thinking all men are rapists, but I feel like Republicans, and not just Republicans and not just evangelicals, but the crowd that's going to say things about, you know, what you wear. So what you're basically saying is men are natural rapists who cannot control themselves. That's what they're saying.
Yeah.
And then they turn it around and they go, well, you hate men because we're saying that they're going to rape you.
Well, and again,
God, don't show them your shoulder.
It's like if I say I hate rapists and you say you hate men, then what are you confessing to? Again, it goes back to that point. And, you know, your point about the evangelical crowd, you probably saw the story. Robert Morris, Donald Trump's spiritual advisor.
Yes.
Pled guilty in October 2025 for raping 5 children. Not one, which is horrific enough as it is.
Right.
5. One of the victims was Cindy Clemenshire, who was only 12 years old when the abuse started. Only 12. And it went on for 4.5 years. This is Trump's spiritual advisor. He got only 10 years in prison. And you know what the worst part is? You know what the worst part is, Kimberly? He was released on March 31st, only 6 months into his sentence. For 5 counts of rape, 6 months in prison. Insane. I mean, it's like this is one of the most powerful people out there. And the question I always have is that how many people knew that he was committing this act and did nothing to stop it. How many people understood that this man is abusing children repeatedly and did nothing to stop it? And worse, we know of five counts. How many more hundreds of counts were there out there?
Well, I mean, it just goes also to the bigger picture. When you look at the president in the United States right now, I mean, I know a lot of people like to say he's not my president, but he's all of our president. He's the freaking president. And I hate him, but he's the president, and he is a rapist, and he is it appears he's a pedophile. You know, I don't have the proof in front of me, but I'm convinced of it. I think, and the fact that everyone who calls him a pedophile, he leaves them all alone. Maybe because he doesn't want to have any kind of lawsuit or discovery. Yeah. But these people are running the country. And so, you know, I mean, when this election happened in 2024, I had a pit in my stomach for 6 weeks. Mm. And one of the first things I did was, and I mean, I feel kind of silly for admitting this, and I have obviously never used it, but I mean, I went out and I bought pepper spray. And I've never even had pepper spray before, even though I've been warned to have it all my life. You know, it's like, I just thought, what if, I don't know. And I mean, obviously I go out and I walk around in the world, cause I really didn't know what was going to happen to this country. I had the worst case scenario. I was 12 years old when my dad got a job. He worked as a cameraman for ABC News in Russia. So I got to live in communist Russia in 1981. And I saw what it was like. And in some, like, now I almost wish I didn't know because it's like, oh my, and I mean, obviously I don't think the United States is ever going to turn into communist Russia, but I know how quickly things, I knew in 2016 when Hillary Clinton had warned us about his Russian connection, and then it came out that the Russians helped him. I just thought, oh my God. And I just thought, you know, how quickly things can change. And I think we really saw it this year. But it's like, I mean, I went out and I bought pepper spray mainly because I just thought, am I even going to be safe walking around in the world? Sure. You know, and I'm a 6 foot tall blonde woman who most of the time people don't mess with me, but I am a woman. And so, you know, I mean, it's terrifying. And these people are running the country. And I guess I want to kind of sidetrack. I didn't write this question, but I'm just wondering, as far as the Epstein files are concerned, do you like, I mean, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but I mean, do you have any kind of a feeling about where this is all going to go or what it might lead to? I don't know that, I don't believe Trump's ever going to go to prison. I don't think anything like that's ever going to happen. But I mean, what do you see coming out of this? Because people aren't letting it go.
I think Trump will deploy nuclear weapons before he goes to prison.
Right, I mean,
that's
I agree.
The horrifying reality of it. I you know, I want to give a shout out to Congressman Summer Lee for igniting this conversation, Congressman Ro Khanna, and then Thomas Massie for continuing to push it forward and getting us to where we are right now. I mean, without the courage of Summer Lee, Ro Khanna, and then Thomas Massie, we would not even be at this point. I think there's two things I want to say to your really important question, Kimberly. One, again, because I'm an eternal optimist, I firmly believe that eventually the truth will come out. It will get the full files. It may not happen until we hopefully have elections in midterms and hopefully have election in 28 and get a Democrat and, you know, in Congress or in the White House as well to release those. So I think it'll happen eventually. I just don't know when. I can't say with confidence when, because obviously the Epstein Files Transparency Act was supposed to be, what, December 19th of last year. Mm-hmm. We're recording this in May of 2026. We're 6 months in and still haven't seen the full files yet. I mean, I think Jamie Raskin said that there are more than 1 million times that his name is mentioned in these files right now, which is mortifying. That's one. The second thing is I need the Democrats to remember that this bullcrap argument of Merrick Garland and Joe Biden of sticking to norms is exactly that. There are no norms. There is no rule book. It's gone. It was burned down decades ago. And your insistence to stick to these norms when nobody else is asinine. It's tying your hand behind your back. And I think what really pisses me off is Joe Biden knew that. It's why he gave a blanket pardon to his closest friends and families and allies, because he knew that we are not in a place of norms and that he can see Trump go after his family very intimately. And he had the wherewithal to say, you know what? This man is crazy. We don't live in normal times. I'm going to give my family a blanket pardon so that they're protected, but then didn't do the same for the rest of the country. He should have fought to expand the court. He should have fought to pass the Voting Rights Act. He should have released the Epstein files, even if there's a court seal on them, because why? That is what the American people needed and deserved, and that is how you would have protected the republic and democracy. So the second part of your question is, we will get to a place of justice, but it will require a new Democratic Party that is committed to working people and is committed to protecting the republic, not through this enormous bullcrap that Merrick Garland put out there, but through recognizing the need of the hour, the moment of the hour, and having the courage to act upon it.
You know, I want to bring something up because I do believe that the Democratic Party needs improvement in certain areas. And as we already have discussed, there's some great people in that party. And I think, like, for the most part, the agenda of that party is in the right, you know, like the legislation most of the time that we see come out of the Democratic Party is more matriarchal. But because we have Citizens United, because politics is what it is, there's going to be corruption. And I know that in this particular climate, and it happens every year, but in this particular climate, all of the Democrats get super defensive, like Democratic voters get super defensive, like, oh, don't attack the party, don't attack the party. And I don't see it as attacking. I always like to say, you know, sports teams like to watch their plays over and over again and say, this is where we fucked up and this is where we were good and let's fix what we fucked up and let's, you know, improve everywhere. And I just think it's more about let's continue to improve, because right now the Democratic Party obviously is going to have, there's no human being, there's no group of people that's ever going to be perfect. There's always going to be room for improvement. And so there, you know, there's absolutely that there. And I agree with you that there sometimes the old guard hangs on too hard to what used to be. And the bottom line is things are always going to change. We are always going to evolve. I was saying to my boyfriend a couple of weeks ago on his podcast that, you know, people have a tendency to go back in history and act like that was the best time. Like in their, it was so much better back in the day. But, you know, the bottom line is whether or not you believe it was better back in your day, we always evolve. It never stays the same. And I think people are so, you know, yes, it was better. It felt better for a lot of people before Trump came into this picture. But it's going back to what you're saying. Yes, Donald Trump is a symptom of what's going on. He's a manifestation of everything that's been happening. It didn't start with the Tea Party, but the Tea Party really, really gave it a big, big push. And then, you know,
well said.
He came, and the Sarah Palin and all of that. And I'm starting to, I'm going off into so many tangents. I'm sorry. You want to say something? So I'm just going
to
let
you. I wanted to build on your point. I want to build on your really important point about this idea of attacking the party. Look, I want to be very clear about this. One, we are not a cult, right? If you want a political party that you can't question its leadership, then join the MAGA cult. This is not the right party for you. That's one. Two, when we're critical, what we're attacking are our elected representatives who are betraying what we elected them to do. Mm-hmm. Just be very, very clear and simple about that. And you can talk about, you know, the fact that, you know, nearly 80% of Democrats want universal health care as a human right. Polling repeatedly shows worst case scenario, 70% of Democrats want universal health. That is a mandate. That is an overwhelming mandate. So when politicians come out and say, yo, we need to protect the for-profit insurance company, bullcrap.
Yeah.
You are betraying what the people are telling you. When 98% of Democrats say stop taking corporate money and run a campaign that is funded by people, you are taking money from the same PACs who are funding insurrectionists. What the hell are you doing? Mm-hmm. That is not attacking the party. That is attacking those who are violating the principles of the party. And so I want to be very, very clear about that. This is not to say let's burn everything down and, and start over. This is to say, hey, you are violating the oath that you took when we elected you. You know, John Fetterman's a great example of that.
I was just thinking of him.
and me being critical of John Fetterman is not saying destroy the whole party. It's saying this guy lied through his teeth and he needs to be accountable for it. Simple as that.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to swing back because I want to ask you back about this Rape Academy thing.
Yeah.
What kind of attention did you get from men? Like what kind of comments were you getting from men on this piece?
Oh my God. And that's actually part of what motivated this newer piece about just being clear that women are not safe around men. But the feedback I think kind of fell into two categories. One, I would say three categories. One was, I would say probably half of men were like, yes, This is good. You're making some really valid points here. You made me think about this deeper. I'm going to do better. There was another segment who said, nah, this doesn't apply to me. I'm not worried about it. And then there was another segment who, very unfortunately, and I even screenshotted some of the responses, said, according to this guy, all men are rapists.
There you
Yes, all men.
go. There you go.
Even though I never said that, but that's just the way they took it. Another guy said, you have 600,000 followers. This is a paid propaganda campaign. I will make sure that he calls me a nasty piece of shit for calling out men. Some other men were, I'm actually reading their comments that they sent to me because I screenshotted and saved them. Said, is every issue a clickbait now? Or you need to start using your brain, or you are spreading misinformation. And so, like, just the insecurity of these people was just insufferable. And unfortunately, this probably represented a good 30 to 40% of the responses that I got. And that to me is, I mean, even 1% is too much, but 30 to 40% is just a really daunting number.
It is, but you know, I mean, being that I've been in this arena online, like online political feminism and politics since 2012. And really pushing, I can say I have seen an improvement. You know, a lot of the men, the way that they responded in 2012 compared to now, I am seeing people waking up, and I'm grateful for it. And I know it's not going to happen overnight. I know it's time. But I mean, you know, I mean, I'm a white woman, obviously, but you know, you're a Muslim man, and we're all in these groups, right? And each group is going to have their set amount of, you know, misogyny, bigotry, whatever you want to call it, prejudice, hate, all of that. So it's like, I mean, I think in a way, it all just mixed together. You're talking here about rape, but it's like all these different groups of people in this country. The whole point of this country in the first place is to have this big melting pot of all of us. That's the freaking point of it. And then, of course, once that starts, then it's the other. And everybody wants to point their finger. But I'm grateful that you wrote this because I'm not only applying what you're saying here, and you know, it's just to women. I mean, I look at this is like for everyone, because it's not just about rape, it's not just about women, it's about bigotry, it's about all of it. And I feel like, you know, you had that experience with that man, and you were able to show him, because I watched the interview. It was funny though, he asked you if he could still call them illegals.
And I'm like, no, people aren't illegal. Absolutely not. They're gonna hold on to that. But you know, Kimberly, I want to build on this really important point you're making, that it's not that the intersectionality of all this. Like, folks need to understand the impact of this on a very practical scale. There's an amazing nonprofit organization called Unchained at Last, and it works on combating child marriage in America. And I don't know if you've had a chance to look at them, Kimberly. So I'll ask you this point. You know, kind of
I
like,
have not, yeah.
So if you were to guess, how many documented child marriages there have been in the United States in the last 25 years? How many would you guess? It
Oh
just
my God. I don't even
off the cuff,
know. I don't know. I
shot in
would
the
just say
dark.
hundreds of thousands.
You're exactly right. More than 300,000 documented child marriages
Oh my God.
in the United States, documented. And so
Yeah.
God knows how many more exist that we have no way of documenting as well, because obviously
Right.
when you're committing an illegal act. But here's the even scarier part. As of right now, do you know how many states still legalize child marriage?
Oh my God, I know. I looked it up, and I don't know how many states, but I mean, there's a whole bunch of states in this country where, like, what, 15 is the age?
Yeah, and some, there's no minimum age. 36 states right now still legalize child marriage.
Oh my
And
God.
so, like we have work to, like, this is systemic, right? This is not like, oh, you know, you're painting all men as rapists. Well, these laws were passed by all men, just so you know. Like, every single state that has these laws where child marriage is legal, that law was by default passed by men, because women weren't elected into office in the late 1800s, early 1900s, early 20th century when these laws were passed. So men are responsible for this de facto, because it was men. 99% of state legislatures, most of them 100%, were men, and particularly white men, because they didn't allow black or brown people in at the time either. But this is my point when I say that men can't set up this system of misogyny, of patriarchy, and then be like, whoa, 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 why are you blaming me? Well, who the hell else am I going to blame? You set this up. Like, show some goddamn accountability. I'm sorry, like, I'm getting upset, and like, it's funny, but you're exactly right. Like, what the hell else are we supposed to do?
No, I know. I mean, that's why I try not to get too angry, because I realize that I mean, it's just going to take time. And I don't know how far we're ever going to go, right? I mean, I think we can absolutely get to a better place. I think we have been at a better place, although we're always going to have, you know, the, I don't know what to call them, the rapists, the negative people, whatever. There's always going to be a group of people in any society that's just going to be awful. But when you have, like what you're saying, when we have laws in place, and just like, if we could get more women judges, you know, get women on the bench. And obviously women aren't the only answer. You can look at Ellen Cannon and say, just because she's a woman doesn't mean she's perfect. But we need the bench to represent, just like we need our government to represent the people, to look like the people. And so there are women in this world and we need them to be judges. And and it's just so, I mean, just a side note, I was rewatching The Bridges of Madison County the other night. And so, you know, in that movie, Meryl Streep falls in love with, what's his name? Of course, why can't I remember anybody's? Clint Eastwood. And so he wants her to go away with him, and she's married and has kids. So she decides that she can't do it, but she starts talking about her husband. And she's like, you know, he's been on this farm forever. He wouldn't know what to do. He's a very gentle man. Mm. And I just, you know what? That never struck me until the other night. Mm. What she was saying is, he doesn't rape me. He doesn't beat me up. And that's something that, that happens a lot. I'm just lucky because he doesn't with me.
Yeah.
And it really just kind of struck me. And, you know, I mean, I think I just am so grateful that a man is taking this on, because I'm so tired of being called a man hater. I mean, I live with a man. I love my father. I love my brother. I have a lot of male friends. And so obviously I don't hate men, and I don't walk around thinking every man is a rapist, but I have been in positions before where I was terrified, and there was no real reason to be. Nobody was threatening me, but I was terrified. And it was basically because of a girlfriend's behavior. A girlfriend of mine was being sexually suggestive around a group of men, and we were alone. And I thought we're going to get gang raped. And thankfully
we
weren't.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the whole point. It's like, you don't know. And we need other men to stand up, because men aren't going to listen to women. I mean, I know, so like you said, you got a bunch of men telling you, oh, you're full of shit, I don't know what you're talking about. So you're getting it too. But as a woman, I have absolutely no credibility with so many of these kinds of guys. But there are guys, men, who are going to look at another man and go, oh, wait a minute, I'll listen because it's a man speaking. And I'm just used to it. Yeah. And so it isn't funny. But I mean, we have to laugh sometimes because of the ignorance.
The levity is important. The levity is important. And you're right. And I think it's on us, you know, especially those of us who are fathers, to start with. Like, I've got two sons, and I've made it explicitly clear to them what consent means and what consent is. And they understand that. And it's beautiful to watch them practice that in real time with their little sister. To know that there are boundaries that apply to all women in every scenario, no matter what. Because how you treat women at home is how you're going to be treating women outside, and even worse. And so it starts with men holding other men accountable, holding younger men accountable. And I will say this, Kimberly, that I am always willing to have the conversation with men. One, because women shouldn't have to. I will have the conversation with men. And two, I will always have the conversation to bring men to a place where they, you know, they can ask the dumb questions. Because look, at the end of the day, if they don't know, they don't know. And we can yell at them for not knowing, or we can say, okay, I'm going to meet you where you are, and I'm going to assume positive intent. I'll give you one really good, I'll give you my own example. When I was in law school, in my, you know, mid-20s, I remember that I went to law school because I wanted to be a human rights lawyer. And I had an amazing law professor who said, hey, you know, there's a poverty law center that has an office of domestic and sexual violence. I can get you involved as an intern there, and you can start working with clients and start supporting women who are survivors of domestic and sexual violence. I said, that sounds great. Let me get involved here. And my very first day in the office, the lawyer that I was working under, she was a great friend, been a mentor for a long time. And she sits me down and she goes to me, she goes, listen, under no circumstance, when you meet with these women who are survivors, do you ever meet one-on-one? And I said, well, why not? She goes, because she doesn't know if you're a rapist. Wow. I'm like, Well, that sounds stupid. Of course I'm not. And she goes, and that's exactly the problem with your reaction. And the only credit I'll give myself is I was smart enough to just shut up and listen. And I'm like, okay, help me understand. And she goes, and then she walked me through exactly what we've been talking about. And mind you, I was in my early 20s, and I should have known by then. I didn't. But I had the extraordinary good fortune of having an amazing woman sit me down and say, listen, here is what is going through a woman's mind in this scenario. This is why, no matter what, you can never be alone in a meeting, in an office, anywhere. The only time that ever happens is when she gives express consent and blah, blah, blah. And we went through a whole process and everything like that. And to that point, for the first 6 months of meeting with some of these clients, there was always somebody with her, a family member, a friend, my legal partner. There was never a scenario. And it took me that experience to, and this is nearly 20 years ago now, it took me that experience to really understand, okay, wow, I'm recognizing my own male privilege in a way that I had never thought about before. And so to me, as direct and harsh as I am about men needing to do better, I also want to add that those men who want to do better and don't know how, we need to create space for them to be able to ask those questions. And men need to take the lead in creating that space and answering those questions, because that's not a burden that needs to be upon a woman. Like, my mentor shouldn't have been the one who had to take on that burden. I'm extraordinarily grateful that she did, but that's not a sustainable model, because of what you said, Kimberly, that men are too arrogant. They're not going to listen to women. So men need to take the lead in this space and be accountable in this space.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm just going to throw in that, you know, in a patriarchy, women hold it up too. A patriarchy is not just like, I hate men, right? It's a power system run by men, and women can hold it up. And I realized just a couple of years ago, only a couple of years ago, I mean, I'm going to be 58 years old in July. So, and I was an actress back in the day in the 90s in Los Angeles. And I was extremely, extremely insecure because I'm 6 feet tall and I wasn't bone thin. I wasn't the size zero that was popular at the time. So I experienced in my life a lot of body hatred. I've had eating disorders. You can't even imagine the horrible things that I've said to myself about my body and how much I've hated my body. And then I just realized a couple of years ago that I was actually feeding the patriarchy. I was pleasing and feeding the patriarchy by doing this, and I didn't even realize it, because I was not, my body is not the patriarchal standard of beauty. And I mean, the same thing with Hollywood. I was slender, but it didn't matter because I was bigger than everybody. And I just felt so disgusting and gross. And then I realized, you know, as a much older person, like, wow, I'm by hating my body and by being so horrible to myself and abusing basically myself, this is the patriarchy. I'm working for the patriarchy. Yeah. So I'm saying that to the men out there who feel defensive and feel like I'm not doing it. It's like, sometimes you don't even realize it, but you just got to kind of take a step back and go, oh, wait a minute. And it's not about blaming. You don't have to blame yourself for something you didn't even realize you were doing. But once you realize you're doing it, then, like, you know, make the effort. You know,
agreed. No, I mean, and that's the unfair standard that we put on women as well. And so I'm sorry that that's an experience that you had to go through, but I'm also grateful that you had the you know, the support and the ability to kind of work through that and be in a much better place now.
Yes, I am. Well, gosh, it was just so interesting to talk to you, and I certainly hope that you'll come back and talk to me another time.
I'd be honored. I've admired your work for a long time, so it's always
thank you.
Great to get these invitations and connect with people that I've admired from afar and build this friendship and partnership too. So thank you for the work you're doing, Kimberly. It's heartfelt, and more of it is needed. So thank you for you.
Well, and right back at you. I mean, thank you for everything you're doing. I've always been impressed with your work. So it's great that we finally got to meet. And before I let you go, please tell everybody where to find you.
Thank you. My Substack, just my name, QasimRashid.com, QasimRashid.com. No paywall. You can be a paid subscriber if you want, but none of my content has any paywall access to it. So I always joke that becoming a paid subscriber gets you no actual value or benefit whatsoever. aside from the feeling that you're supporting someone who's trying to do right in the world. And then I'm at Qasim Rashid across all social platforms, whatever your platform of choice is.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And we'll talk again.
Thank you.
Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark. Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.